Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. Today, I am joined by Lori Calhoun, Senior Fellow at the Libertarian Institute and author of We Kill Because We Can, From Soldiering to Assassination in the Drone Age. Ms. Calhoun, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
What is just war theory, and what can it teach us about how to determine the legitimacy of a current or future military intervention?
Good question. Just war theory is an apparatus devised by Catholic theologians long, long ago, beginning with St. Augustine in the 4th century AD, and it was elaborated further by other scholars throughout the Middle Ages up to St. Thomas Aquinas, and even up to the present day, there are still scholars who are tweaking it. And what it does is it offers leaders a framework by which to determine whether or not the wars they envision are permitted or not. Are they just or are they unjust? So the reason why this was important way back when it first was devised, was because these people were Christians. So if you're a Christian, on the face of it, you can't kill people. Thou shalt not kill. So they needed to have some framework to make it possible for leaders who wanted to go to war to go to war. And so they devised these conditions, the jus ad bellum conditions on going to war and the jus in bello conditions on conduct during a war already waged. So in some ways, the criteria are commonsensical. So legitimate authority. You have to be in a legitimate authority in order to take your country to war or to take your group to war. It has to be a just cause. You can't just go wage a war for some random reason. The means of war have to be proportional to what you're trying to accomplish. Okay. A really good one is it has to be last resort. Okay. So there, you have to have exhausted all other non-war means to a resolution of the conflict before you can go to war, according to traditional just war theory. And then, you know, once the war is waged, there are conditions you're supposed to follow in the war, jus in bello, which include treating soldiers as human beings, not targeting non-combatants, treating captured soldiers as though they were non-combatants, okay? So they're no longer armed, so they're the equivalent of non-combatants once they've been stripped of their weapons. And so this little framework has been used, it's been trotted out by leaders throughout history to rationalize their wars. So in my view, my rather scathing critique of the just war theory is called War and Delusion, A Critical Examination, where I try to show that rather than restraining leaders from waging wars, which they should not be taking their groups into, it has served as a rhetorical propaganda apparatus to make it easier to take people to war. So you just say, oh, you know, this is a just war. George H.W. Bush famously did this before the 1991 Gulf War. He trotted out explicitly the theory and went down the bullet points and said, you know, Saddam Hussein committed this crime, so this is a just cause. We have to, you know, free the Kuwaiti land and redress this wrong that was done by Saddam Hussein. It's a last resort. We can't negotiate with him because he's a madman. So the only thing we can do is go to war. You know, it went on and on and on. And so he got the entire world practically behind that call to war. And can it be used to help determine whether or not a war is just? I think if you actually read the requirements literally, it turns out that nearly none of the wars during our lifetime certainly have satisfied the criteria. The problem is that the tenets of just war theory are so malleable and they're subject to infinite interpretation. And the ultimate problem is that the legitimate authority himself has the interpretive prerogative about how to interpret every other requirement. Okay, so once you have a legitimate authority named, then he decrees that this is a just cause from his interpretation, and he decrees that this is the last resort from his interpretation, and that the means are proportional. And then he says, okay, look, we've satisfied all these requirements, let's go. So.
You wrote a paper titled How Violence Breeds Violence, Some Utilitarian Considerations, where you discuss important long-range consequences rarely mentioned in utilitarian defenses of particular decisions to engage states in war. The reason I think this is so important is because the great propaganda trick is to assume no downsides. We should defend Taiwan. We should defend Ukraine. We should liberate Iraq. We should liberate Japan without ever talking about the downsides. There's no costs in this war. There's just a bunch of benefits. And the question is, do you want to have a bunch of benefits or are you with the terrorists? So when it comes to laying out the costs of war, what is the utilitarian case against military interventions?
Okay, the utilitarian case is very strong, and it has to include what you just mentioned, which are the long-term effects, which are never, ever, ever considered before going to war. Or if they're considered, they're minimized and falsified by saying, oh, we'll be in and out. Okay, we're going to go in, we're going to remove Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, and then we'll be out of there, and then Iraq will be free. That's how it's painted. In reality, as we saw through the war on terror, that's never how it works out. It works out that you end up killing, you know, millions of people, displacing millions more, maiming millions of people, leaving, you know, thousands upon thousands of war orphans and widows, basically wrecking the entire country is what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places in the Middle East. So the utilitarian argument against war would be you have to look at not only the short-term consequences of redressing what you claim to be a wrong or dealing with the problem that you believe needs to be resolved, but also looking at the long-term consequences. And one of the long-term consequences, which I also discuss in the chapter on utilitarianism in War and Delusion, which is really important, is that you have to look at the effect of normalizing violence as a means to conflict resolution. So every time your country goes out and bombs to smithereens a country, you're saying to everyone that this is how you resolve conflict. And we see this, we see the consequences of this in the homeland. Every time one of these crazy persons goes out and does a mass shooting, he has some grievance and he's decided that the way you act on your unhappiness and your dissatisfaction with some aspect of society is you go kill a bunch of people. So that is a really important long-range consequence, which is never taken into consideration by either short-term utilitarian advocates for war or by just war theorists.
You have been writing, the papers I was looking at went back to the late 90s on this issue, and I was born in 96, and the biggest thing in my life was always about the terrorists, and the terrorists are going to come kill us, and it's sort of random. It's not like we see the army coming over the hill. It's like the person next to you, they could be in Afghanistan, or they could be in Phoenix, we don't know, and this was one of the high alerts that we were always sort of walking on eggshells around. And now that has like disappeared from the headlines completely. Now it's Russia, now it's China. What happened to all of these terrorists who wanted to kill us for our freedoms?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think that the big mistake post 9/11 is to cast the crimes committed on that day as acts of war. It was not a declaration of war. It was a group of crimes committed by a small group of people. And in retaliation, this was used as a pretext for waging full-scale wars on multiple nations throughout the Middle East. So that kept us pretty busy for 20 years. And then now we've moved on to other crises. So we had the COVID crisis that detracted everyone. And now, because I guess everyone was, you know, busy worrying about COVID for 2 years, now suddenly Ukraine becomes the big issue, and Russia's invasion of Ukraine and our support of the Ukrainian sovereignty with no apparent memory of what happened throughout the war on terror. Okay, so you see Blinken coming out and saying, oh, you can't just invade a country, but we just did that. You know, we just invaded country after country. And at the same time that he's saying this, we're bombing places all over the Middle East continually. So we're still carrying out these drone strikes in Somalia recently, in Syria, et cetera. And so it's a real contradiction because on the one hand, the war machine is going on in the background, okay, while Ukraine is on the front pages. But in some ways, it's like the attention of the populace has been switched so as to diminish the actual implications of our war on terror for the conflict in Ukraine.
When it comes to normalizing violence, are you familiar with the Omar Mateen situation at Pulse nightclub?
I mean, I think I know basically this was this act that happened a few years ago, right?
Yeah. Okay. I should have talked with you.
I vaguely remember it, but I shouldn't have just randomly. No, it's
it
okay. You can refresh my memory. I mean, I recall that there were various ways of interpreting it, but what was your interpretation?
Well, for years, I had assumed that this was a homophobic attack or a gay hate crime because it took place at a gay nightclub, the Pulse nightclub, in, I believe, Orlando, Florida. 50 people were killed. And then, some years later, Glenn Greenwald shares the 911 transcript. And the transcript is, hi, this is, my name's Omar Mateen. I'm with the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. America needs to stop bombing Iraq and Syria. You're killing women and children. America mm-hmm. and Russia are killing women and children. He mm-hmm. says this probably 10 times. I read mm-hmm. it, and it was a little... But it was so repetitive that I just had to like cut some of it out. I should have brought that up with you beforehand. I'm actually going to cut
No, but you know, you're right. Actually, every domestic terror case throughout the war on terror involved people who, when they actually, you know, made it to a trial and weren't just whacked, they said that they were retaliating to the drone wars, to the attacks on civilians in Pakistan and Iraq and Afghanistan. All of them said this. So he wasn't alone. Anwar al-Awlaki, who of course was executed by a drone on, I think, September 30th, 2011, he also inveighed against our lawless assault of the people on the people of the Middle East in the way that Osama bin Laden did, you know, before 9/11, which is not to excuse 9/11, of course, but it's to say that these people all had grievances and they followed the framework established by our repeated use of military force in addressing conflict. All of them did. So what is jihad but the Islamist version of just war theory? Okay, so we have a grievance and we're going to address it, and this is the only way we can do it. You need to be prepared for jihad and go out just in the way that the just warriors would say. So they're completely analogous. I mean, from the perspective of the perpetrators of these terrorist acts, they're doing what they have to do because they cannot stand by and continue to watch what is going on.
You wrote a book, We Kill Because We Can, From Soldiering to Assassination in the Drone Age. Which countries has the U.S. military used drone strikes in, and for what alleged purpose?
Oh, all over the map, really. So certainly all over the Middle East. Obviously, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan, Syria, all over North Africa, too. There are drone bases now dotting Africa. So drones are launched from these places. And we don't know about all of them. We only know about the ones they admit to. But the danger is growing for people in countries which have yet to be democratized. And the reason is because the despots of these leaders are able to use this drone technology to eliminate their political enemies. It's actually kind of awful. So, you know, we say that we're the champions of democracy, but in fact, we're force multipliers of tyrants all throughout the Middle East.
Yeah, if it's so vitally important to give a person a vote once every 4 years, I think not murdering them would be a little more important. We might want to put that above, like, If I lost my right to vote, that, you know, maybe I wouldn't be too happy. If I were murdered, I wouldn't have the ability to not be happy. So can we have some standards?
That's a really important point. And people forget about that. I mean, when you just let loose the dogs of war, so to speak, you're about to annihilate people's basic, not only, you know, rights to choice, but their basic right to even have an opinion. So you've basically tossed out all of your principles once you start just killing people willy-nilly because they might possibly pose a possible future threat to your country. I mean, it's wild what happened throughout the war on terror. I mean, we completely abandoned any notion of due process, any notion of caring about the human nature of our victims. Many of these victims, as the war on terror progressed, the victims became younger and younger. So we were killing people, you know, 16-year-olds, impressionable teenagers who had joined up forces with the local terrorist group because they saw some child murdered by a drone. So that's why they signed up. So these people were not, most of these people were not in any sense intrinsically evil. They were angry. They were angry and they retaliated because they just, as I said earlier, with regard to the domestic terrorist cases, they couldn't stand by and do nothing because they're so outraged by what happened. And I think it's a tragedy. I argue this at the end of We Kill Because We Can. It's a tragedy that we've killed some of the brightest and, you know, most promising young people throughout the Middle East because they had the sense of moral outrage against the invasion, which in fact was the invasions, which were in fact illegal. So they were acting on their perception of the wrongdoing that was being perpetrated by the United States. And so they teamed up with the local thugs, which were usually ISIS or Al-Qaeda. And as a result, they were killed.
What data do you have on the number of civilian deaths when it comes to this drone program operation? And in this case, for the sake of argument, a civilian would be a death that occurred as a causal result of the drone who was not the intended target. Any statistics on that?
There are statistics, and they vary widely depending upon the source. Okay, so we know that thousands of people have been killed by drones. So that's a given. Obama admitted it in his report in 2016. We have killed, you know, it was approaching 3,000 in that report. It's probably many times more than that, according to several different sources, Reprieve, et cetera. The problem is that the administration not only killed thousands of people, but they redefined what constituted an enemy killed in action. So an enemy killed in action under the Obama administration became any male who was killed by a drone who was of military age. And we know this thanks to the whistleblower Daniel Hale, now serving a federal prison sentence. We know that the United States government effectively inverted the burden of proof and defined anyone they killed as guilty until proven innocent, provided they were within the age of military capability. So if they are like between the ages of 16 and 50 or somewhere around there, then they were defined as enemy killed in action when they were killed by drones. So what's the upshot of this? It means that if there were innocent teenagers killed by these drones, we don't know from the administration because they claim that they are all terrorists by definition. So you're brown skinned, you're 18 years old, and you're in a place where they think terrorists are hiding out. They kill you. They call you a dead terrorist. You become, in effect, convicted of terrorism through state execution. So to answer your initial question, we don't know how many civilians have been killed because it depends on whether you deny the possibility of a military-age male non-combatant in these areas, okay? Because if you deny that possibility, then it looks like, oh, there have been very few civilian casualties. If you recognize that, in fact, that's completely bogus because these people are being killed on the basis of circumstantial evidence, including bribed information derived from destitute people who need money, and also things like drone footage and SIM card data, which is completely circumstantial, would never hold up in a court of law in the United States. then you realize that lots of these people probably were innocent. Another argument for concluding that among the thousands of targets who were killed by the United States government, according to the United States government itself, many of them were innocent. A really strong argument for this is that the men who were rounded up and thrown into Guantanamo Bay, it turned out that 85% of them were innocent. Okay, so since they used the same kind of intel to draw up their hit list, you know, when they stopped imprisoning people and just decided kill, don't capture, we'll just kill everybody. Since they used the same sort of intel in drawing up hit lists for drone strikes as they did in rounding up the people who ended up in Guantanamo Bay, 85% of whom were totally innocent, you have really good grounds for believing that lots of the people killed by drones have been innocent.
When it comes to legitimate, so to speak, targets, when if you were having to steel man the case for the Pentagon, what is something that they would consider a really legitimate target and a big success in the drone program?
Well, they determine that someone is potentially dangerous by his associations with other people who have been determined to be potentially dangerous. So this is a really slippery slope, and the problem is that there's a confirmation bias going on. So they think that someone is suspicious, and then he acts in ways which are then interpreted as suspicious, and then they kill him. So a really good example of this was the drone strike on August 29th, 2021 in Kabul, as the US government was departing. They killed this guy who was driving around a white Toyota Corolla and doing stuff that quote unquote looked suspicious. So he was like moving water and visiting people all over the city, and they killed him with a drone strike, and along with him, nine other people, seven of whom were children because they were in the vicinity. And it turned out that the guy was an aid worker. Okay, but they had received intel according to which some guy driving a white Toyota Corolla was planning a strike on Kabul airport. So this was the basis for their strike. And they came out after the strike and said, oh, we got rid of this bad guy. We thwarted an attack on the Kabul airport. Turned out 2 days later, a journalist on the ground ascertained that, in fact, the guy had no connection to terrorist groups. In fact, he was an aid worker. And the U.S. government had no knowledge of his existence the day before they killed him. So this shows you how flimsy the evidence actually can be. The difference in this case and all of the other cases is that there were people on the ground who could offer a counter narrative. Usually the Pentagon controlled the narrative. So they said they killed somebody and it was like end of story because there was no one on the ground to be able to, you know, deny what they said. And in this case, because they were withdrawing from Afghanistan, they no longer controlled the narrative. So the question is, how many of the people who were killed throughout the war on terror were more like this aid worker and, you know, who was for 3 days claimed to be a dead terrorist, in fact, completely innocent of any wrongdoing whatsoever, but because of bad intel, he was pegged as a terrorist. And then when they observed him from drones, et cetera, they interpreted everything he did as suspicious. So to answer your question, that's a good example of the type of intel that has been used to kill people.
How many drones has the U.S. government used? I remember thinking it was like in the dozens because I'd hear about it and I go, well, we must be hearing about it because it's so seldom. So maybe there's one or two a year, or could it be as high as hundreds, or are there literally thousands of these things happening and the news just would rather talk about trivial nonsense?
Well, certainly I think we have grounds for believing that they're happening more frequently than we know about, because the Trump administration stopped reporting on them. Okay, so Obama used hundreds of drone strikes, hundreds. He really upped the level, the frequency of the drone strikes. He used hundreds of them and he killed thousands of people. The Bush administration used, I think, 50, and Obama used like maybe 500. And then Trump just decided, you know, he decided it was tough to like not report on it. So they just didn't report on it. They put James Mattis on a long leash and he just got to do, you know, it was a free for all throughout the Middle East. And no one really knows how many people were killed during that period because the government stopped reporting. Biden now is reporting, you know, when there's a drone strike and they consider it to be a success. So, for example, the recent strike on Ayman al-Zawahiri, also in Kabul, about a year after this poor aid worker and his family were all annihilated. Biden came out and said, oh, I just killed this number two Al-Qaeda guy in Kabul. So the strikes are admitted when they look like some sort of victory in the war on terror. So Biden said, look, you know, I'm as good as Obama. He killed Osama bin Laden. Well, I killed, Ayman al-Zawahiri. It's an interesting case. This was just this past summer. I think it was July 30th. Interesting case because there's no forensic evidence that they actually got this guy. This guy has been reported dead before in the Pakistani press. And the Taliban, upon the release of this news and the big fanfare that the media gave Biden, you know, oh, he killed this evil guy. You know, they wanted to recreate the feeling of the populace after Osama bin Laden was killed. So they wanted to sort of, I think, improve his ratings. But in any event, the Taliban came out and said, oh, actually, that house was empty. There was no one in it. So we still don't know to this day whether or not this guy was killed by the Biden administration. But we do know that he bragged about it. And it was taken to be, you know, a proof that he's a great leader, I guess. That was like the marketing line.
Did they make sure to throw his body in the ocean afterwards?
Yeah, no. If they killed no one, there was nobody. The alternative is they killed their hapless aid worker or someone else who happened to be in the house. But since there's been no forensic evidence produced whatsoever, I mean, I think that if there were a body, there would have to be DNA evidence, confirmatory or disconfirmatory, one way or the other. I mean, especially the U.S. government has been hunting this guy for 20 years, so they surely have DNA evidence. I mean, you know, some sort of trace from a glass that he drank out of or whatever. They've got to have DNA evidence. And if in fact he was who they said he was, then there would be forensic evidence. But the Pentagon itself said we don't anticipate having, you know, being able to share any forensic evidence. Well, if there's no body, then there is no forensic evidence. So I mean, basically there are two options. Either the Taliban is right, you know, you never really like to believe the Taliban, but it's their country now, and they said there was no one in the house. And if there's no body, then there's no forensic evidence. If there is a body, and it wasn't Ayman al-Zawahiri, then it was someone else, and presumably someone's husband or, you know, child. And so there's got to be DNA evidence of that person's identity. So there has to be DNA evidence if in fact there is a body. But we have heard nothing about this. It just sort of, you know, we just moved on to something else. You know, Putin is Hitler, you know, so it's like the latest.
You mentioned Daniel Hale. Are there any other drone program whistleblowers that people should look into if they want to get hopefully the most accurate, least popular information about this issue?
There have been quite a few drone operators who have come forth. There are some good documentary films on this, and there's a group of apostate drone operators who abandoned the profession because they couldn't do it, morally speaking, anymore. They just couldn't do it. I have an article about this at my blog. It's called Chew 'em Up and Spit 'em Out, the Drone Operator Edition. And it actually gives some links to some of these people. Michael Haas is one of them. Chan Westmoreland. I'm not sure actually how to pronounce that name. I think it's an Irish name. C-I-A-N. How do you pronounce that? So anyway, he's very active on Twitter. And so these are people who have come out and said, you know, this is like so wrong. We're just like killing people on the basis of circumstantial evidence. And I'm not going to do it anymore. Brandon Bryant is probably the most famous of them. He came out back in 2012 after having served as a drone operator for 5 years. And he went all over the place. He was in Der Spiegel, did interviews in Germany, Norway, all over the place. I have not heard anything from him, you know, in a couple of years now. I don't know where he is. He was in Montana for a while. But he was really good about coming out and just explaining his experience, how when he left the program, he was presented with a scorecard indicating that he had contributed to the deaths of 1,626 people. And he has nightmares about this now because he has memories of cases where he was ordered to do a strike where there was a small, what looked like a small child in the room. And his supervisors would say things like, oh no, that was a dog. But he has an incredible sense of guilt and moral injury for what he did. You know, he went into it thinking that he was going to be defending the country. And he also, it was painted when they recruited him as a kind of James Bond thing, like, ooh, you know, I'm going to be this cool guy saving the United States. And then he came out of it feeling like, wow, I'm like a contract killer. I just kill people at the order of the customer. And there have been other drone operators more recently who have come out and elucidated that they're told that they have to kill whomever, quote unquote, the customer says needs to be killed. So the customer, I mean, who's the customer? You know, it's like some group of anonymous analysts who have decided that they want to rack up some more dead terrorists. And so their criteria are going to depend on their own moral views. You know, they may have no problem with killing lots of people just to up their tally.
I know you wrote a book titled Philosophy Unmasked, A Skeptic's Guide. From a philosophical standpoint, who do you think holds more moral culpability, the order giver or the order follower in those situations?
Yeah, it's a tough question because soldierly obedience is justified tactically to keep everyone in the platoon alive. So people think actually that they have to follow orders because if not, they're going to endanger their buddies. The interesting case with drone operators, though, is that it's no longer the case that their lives are on the line. And so in this case, I think that the moral responsibility is borne by the actor who stays in the job because it's lucrative, even though he believes in his heart of hearts that what he's doing is wrong. It has become more of a case of corruption where people are agreeing to do this in the way that a hitman will agree to kill someone provided that the amount of cash being offered to him is large enough. So it's completely analogous because the drone operators are not themselves risking their own lives. They're not soldiers in the traditional sense because they're acts of killing cannot be construed as literal acts of self-defense. A combatant on the ground who's facing a deadly enemy who's about to kill him can regard what he's doing as a choice of kill or be killed. Drone operator cannot do that because it's false. If the drone operator declines to push a button, he's not going to be harmed. He's in a trailer in Nevada or wherever he is. So it's not a question of kill or be killed. It's a question of, should I do what these people are telling me to do, even though it goes against my conscience?
Yeah. And even the mafia isn't able to take people's income by force, so they have more voluntary funding. And the mafia generally have a rule that they don't go after family members. So I think this is like the worst thing in the world. And I think you're doing a phenomenal job tackling this this vitally important issue. We've gone over the results of the war on terror. We've gone over the motives for originating it and just war theory as well. We've talked about the effects. Are there any other bullet points that people need to know about the war on terror before it completely is memory hold and we forget it ever happened?
Well, it cannot be memory hold. I mean, it's been put on the back burner now by the media, but we have to remember that the media has been completely co-opted by the military. It's a part of the sprawling military, industrial, congressional, academic, media, pharmaceutical, banking, logistics. I have eight of them. It's an octopoid in my view now. So, yeah. So been completely co-opted. So when you turn the television on, you are facing propaganda at this point, and it's largely driven by the military. So also pharma, we learned in the period of COVID. So we cannot memory hole it. And people, I wish we had a competent fourth estate to call into question when people like Blinken get on the stage and say, you can't just invade a country and you know, yeah. as though the war on terror never happened, you know, as though none of this happened. And then on top of all that, they're trying to memory hole literally Julian Assange and everything that Julian Assange revealed. I mean, nothing would memory hole the war on terror better than the annihilation of Julian Assange, and that seems to be what their goal is at this point. They've managed to suppress him to the point where he can no longer reveal any of the sort of secrets that make it possible for United States citizens to know what their government is doing supposedly on their behalf and using their money. So a good example would be Nord Stream. We don't know who sabotaged the Nord Stream pipelines, but if we had a whistleblower who came forward, who was a part of it and could provide documentation showing like, look, these people actually perpetrated this. If it was the United States, for example, then it was a declaration of war on Russia. And without people like Julian Assange, we're never going to find out, because anyone who dares to speak out is going to be thrown into federal prison. I mean, some people might dare to do it anyway, but they also risk their own lives by doing that. And so we need more people like Julian Assange and organizations like WikiLeaks. And we need to, I think, defend Julian Assange at this point, because without that surrogate for the fourth estate, which no longer exists, we no longer have an effective press, then we really are lost, because we're going to be just in this tunnel of government produced disinformation and never know exactly what is going on, which is where we seem to be right now. It's quite frightening, to be honest.
When it comes to solutions to something like this, Mary J. Ruart, I really like her idea of, what if you just started issuing these as court cases and you tried taking soldiers or generals or politicians to court and trying to file a lawsuit as a way of bringing attention to it, and maybe some heroic judge, for example, maybe Joe Biden, conspiracy to commit murder in Kabul, August 29th, 2001. I mean, something like that. I love that we're getting this information out there and people are, you know, becoming more skeptical of the military industrial complex and the state and everything. But as far as like, what do we have to do to get this nightmare to end? They're provoking a war with China over Taiwan. They're provoking one with Russia. Like, if inciting a riot, I'm against inciting riots, that's bad. These people are inciting nuclear mass murder, and they they get applauded by the Council on Foreign Relations for it. So as far as solutions, where do we go?
Okay, so my latest article at the Institute is, in a nutshell, to save the Republic, abolish the black budget. So basically, the black budget is being used to perpetrate crimes which actually harm the Republic. Okay, so if we are risking nuclear war, let's say for the sake of argument that Nord Stream was a U.S. sabotage, if that was done using taxpayers' money, then we are being sabotaged by the existence of the black budget, because these things can be carried out without our permission, without our knowledge, without any accountability, and they can actually lead, in this case, to nuclear holocaust. So something's got to be done to rein these people in, because they obviously are completely unhinged. It's a complete, you know, loose cannon at this point. The fact that we're fomenting war on multiple fronts, okay, not only with Russia in Ukraine, but also between China and Taiwan, and also with Iran simultaneously. It's a complete train wreck in terms of diplomacy. We no longer have diplomats. What we have are warmongers masquerading as diplomats. They refuse to negotiate. Well, when you refuse to negotiate, what you're doing, getting back to the just war theory, is you're saying, oh, war is a last resort. We can't negotiate, so we have to go to war. And it's a fallacy. It's completely false. We're not able to negotiate because you don't want to negotiate. Why they want to do this, you know, this is up to interpretation. Some people think it's just a matter of profiteering. Okay, we want to keep doing wealth transfer from citizens to the MIC. So all these weapons that are going to Ukraine, in fact, you know, that's a lot of profit for the for-profit military industry. And they want to stretch it out as long as they can. The problem in this case is they're actually risking the annihilation of civilization by doing this, because they keep goading Putin to the point where he may let's hope not, but he may at some point just throw up his hands and say, whatever, you know, let's do this. We don't know. But when you continually threaten him with regime change and even assassination, then you have removed all of the constraints in place for MAD, mutually assured destruction, which, you know, supposedly is what prevented nuclear war throughout the Cold War, because each side knew that if they initiated the war, then they would also be destroyed. Well, if Putin already thinks he's going to be destroyed, then that whole framework falls apart. MAD no longer works. So to answer your question, the way to get out of this nightmare is to rein in these people who are committing crimes in secret. They're fomenting coups, inciting uprisings, committing, you know, flat out crimes in the case of Nord Stream, I believe. And causing us all great danger. Rather than protecting us, they're actually degrading our state of security, and in fact causing a huge amount of misery. I mean, lots of people are really worried about this now, because it just doesn't seem like there's anyone really in charge, anyone competent in charge. They have no idea what is going on, why this continues on, and why Congress continues to allow the government to print money and ship it abroad, even as our own economy tanks. It's unbelievable, really. And it can only be explained by the fact that the media has been captured by the military. So the media, you know, if you're watching television, you are getting a really distorted view of the world. And my one hope on the international front is that countries in Europe are finally going to say, wait a minute, these like basket cases are actually endangering us. Not only are they preventing us from getting energy for this winter, they're actually provoking the possibility of a nuclear war. And it's possible. I mean, I believe that the people of Germany, for example, are all on the whole a rational lot. And at some point they're going to say, you know, allying ourselves with this loose cannon is not helping us anymore. And so we may see new alliances forming in the region as the people stand up and say, no, we won't allow our government to continue to support initiatives which are clearly against our own best interests.
The book is We Kill Because We Can, From Soldiering to Assassination in the Drone Age. Thanks to everyone for watching the Libertarian Institute. Ms. Calhoun, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.